This is Bondi Tunes International, the week that was.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes broadcasting around the world, a world of time zones. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia, and I'm joined by Thomas Booker in San Antonio de Bayar, which I always do in a French accent. I have no idea why. In Texas, in the United States. Welcome back to the show, Thomas.
Hello, Henry.
Yeah.
Welcome to Texas, and daylight savings time has started.
So. Yeah. It takes me a week to get used to this, and it's a nightmare for someone like me. Not because of me, but because I talk, obviously, to people in different parts of the world. Time zones have changed. Where you are in Texas, you've got an hour more of sunlight. It does take a while to adjust, doesn't it?
Yes, it messes with, you know, since I'm rapidly heading toward geezerhood, it's becoming more of an annoyance. It's just because...
Geezerhood?
Yes.
You old geezer.
I don't like any gold darn changes going on around
God
here.
God darn it! Did you always... When did daylight savings start in your neck of the woods? I mean, was this something that happened back in the 40s or when?
Oh, God. Well, it was actually let me check my history now. I think daylight savings time was actually initiated in 1914, I think 1915, when the United States went to war, and it was to keep more hours open for the factory productions. And I could be wrong. I think I'm pretty sure it was either World War I or World War II that they initiated daylight savings time to increase productivity.
Wow.
So
that's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously with more daylight, and it's not actually more daylight. It's a psychological thing, isn't it?
It is.
It's the same. The sun comes up, it goes down. Of course, in summer, the sun is up longer anyway. The irony of this, and you being a scientific type, please explain to me why in winter the sun is closer to the Earth, but it goes down faster, and in summer it's further. I'm probably making a fool of myself here, because it actually all of a sudden seems quite practical to me. The sun is further away from the Earth in, and correct me if I'm wrong, in summertime, so therefore it covers more of the Earth for longer?
Well, it has to do, yes. What's happening, okay, here we go. As was taught in our elementary school science class that most people, but the planet Earth is, of course, it's rotating. You have to realize that this is a huge, massive sphere, and there's all kinds of weird stuff going on inside of it in terms of having a metal to plastic core and things sloshing around in it, which, by the way, the rotation of the Earth and the heat inside of it and the convection processes are what cause it creates actually an electrical current, electrical exchange of metals, moving metals, and that's what generates the Earth's magnetic field. Mm-hmm. So that for that reason, that's one of the really good things about it, because it's as a result of having the Earth's magnetic field, we have a deflection shield that prevents particles from the sun and from outside. Protects us from the radiation, but also keeps our atmosphere from being, as they would say, sputtered away by the solar wind. Mm. And over millions and millions of years, and that's what happened to Mars, basically, because Mars does not have a magnetic field, and its atmosphere is almost completely blasted away. It's very, very thin. A person could not go out and walk on Mars and breathe there.
Yes, and it's interesting you mentioned that. Of course, recently they've put some kind of machine on Mars, haven't they?
Yes, Perseverance rover. Yes.
What do they find? Did they find any water?
It's in the process of becoming. As it is, this machine is extremely complicated. And even though it landed like a month and a half ago, I think, which was really cool. I watched it real time. That was fun. That was
wow.
That was shortly after during our snowstorm, and that was sort of a fun thing to watch toward the end of it. But basically, because it's they have to run through all sorts of diagnostics on it. So before they do anything with the mechanism, they try to see if there's anything out of place or amiss, and they don't want to have any sudden, turn things on and run the motors and all of that. They just have to do a careful inspection and a careful systems analysis, so they make sure there are no anomalies, so that they can bring the thing up. But it's festooned with cameras, And the cameras are multispectral, so they're actually taking images in a different light so they can eventually do spectrographic analysis.
What's the long-term goal of this? I mean, you just mentioned that humans could not be walking on Mars anytime soon. If ever.
No. And also the Mars, because it doesn't have a magnetic field, is bombarded by radiation. It's a really grim place to be.
Doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
No, I personally look askance at all the talk about creating Mars colonies, and I also look askance at creating lunar colonies.
And then there are the movies from the 1950s and the Martians.
Oh, the Martians. Oh, yes.
The movie
I would recommend best is, if you can get it, is Invaders from Mars.
Oh, what about
1956, I think.
Okay. What about War of the Worlds, which, of course...
War of the Worlds, yes.
Sorry. That was originally a radio play.
It was originally a novel by H.G. Wells. Actually, that's a great story for you for radio.
Yes.
Because it was a drama. Orson Welles, before he was making movies, he had a theater. And by the way, he was an extreme leftist. And he had his whole theater troupe, the Mercury Theater, was also swarming with all sorts of people who were communists and progressives. And it thrived during the Depression era, which is some background information you didn't know. But anyway, he had a radio theater he took Mercury Theater to radio. And for Halloween stunt, he had a radio performance, a recreation of the H.G. Wells novel. Mm. But the cool thing about it, and I'm sure somewhere you can get it online.
Yes.
Now.
If I do manage to get an audio grab of this, it will go in right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks for the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill.
If you listen to it, it is incredibly sophisticated in the way it presents news flashes. And it was an incredibly accurate, faithful reproduction of the way news was broadcast back then. So it's really eerie. And
it did frighten the crap out of people, didn't it?
Yes, it did, because people came in on early on it, and all they were listening, and that's because of the accuracy of the way he had the news, the field reporters describing the situation, and there was this developing accounts of an invasion. This was it was taking place in New Jersey. I can't remember, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. And there were people living in near Groversville, New Jersey.
Oh dear!
They were panicking, and they were going out with guns. And toward the end of it, I mean, it did create a huge panic. And at that time, the consumers of media weren't quite that sophisticated. Hmm. And so also at that era, it was a very tense time internationally because. Edward R. Murrow and his team had put together a rapid report from all the nations in Europe as they were monitoring Adolf Hitler's expansion and takeover, the Anschluss into Austria, and all of these other really gut-wrenching, ominous news items coming out. It was in that context. People had been listening to that over and over.
So that was the mindset of people, was fear because of all the radio reports coming out of Europe.
They were already primed for it. And then Orson Welles came along and did this incredibly, for its time, it's an incredibly sophisticated chain of pseudo-reportage. And it fit exactly. And he actually accurately copied what he was hearing on the radio from the reporters in Europe and everything. So as a result of that accuracy and the fact that the context of it was lost when people tuned in first, that yes, it turned out to be, it created a panic. And
it's interesting that in the middle of this, and of course this wouldn't have been a thing that they would have done in those days, because I think this went on for hours, didn't it?
It was an hour and a half, I think.
I'm just wondering how people were led to believe this in the context that it just went on and on and on. I would have thought they would have had commercial breaks.
They had commercial breaks, yes, even then. But this
seemed live. It just seemed real. I mean, it's, every time I talk to someone like you at the 10-minute mark, which it is now, I'd let our listeners know that I'm talking with Thomas Booker, our correspondent in North America in Texas. Interesting that he carried this for hours. I can only imagine the newspapers the next day.
Oh yeah, the next day it was a huge scandal. It was all over the place. Now really the panic and the terror, I think, was confined. It wasn't nationwide, but it was confined to the area of rural New Jersey, because he was, once again, I'm not sure if I'm correct if he's talking about whether Martian's Landing was Grover's Mill or not, but anyway, I recommend anybody to go on YouTube or find some place where they can hear the full recording and be stunned. But it's also the same, if anybody ever watched the movie Citizen Kane, which Orson Welles directed, he did an incredibly accurate job of recreating the newsreels of the time. And so the opening scenes of Citizen Kane, he really picked up on the media. He picked up on the ambiance and the style of all the news reporting and the newsreels in the theaters at that time. So that's another thing to watch. I mean, Orson Welles was a very savvy observer of the media and the culture of the times. And
I would love to know what he would feel were he alive today about media now, and particularly social media. I mean, the guy was ahead of his time in terms of broadcasting. I know he comes from the stage and he's a writer, he's a prolific writer, but he would be going nuts now if he was born 40 years later, and he'd be in his 40s maybe now, and he would be going nuts, I reckon. What would he create in this day and age?
I would be really intrigued by it, because he was really sensitive to the media of his day, and it would be interesting to see what he did with it. That's a good speculation that we.
Yes, I just want to get back to atmospherics and the weather and the skies that we're talking about. Back in the 80s, the late 80s, I was living in London, and Margaret Thatcher, which is obviously in power at the time for the right-wing Tory party, she did one good thing in the late 80s with regard to the ozone layer. Not a lot of people remember this, but fridges were emanating gases that were affecting the ozone layer. So Margaret Thatcher put an order in through Parliament to change how fridges were made. And the ozone layer was a huge issue leading up to the 90s, and then it sort of got good for a while, Thomas. It seemed like the ozone was repairing itself.
Well, it did. It actually was. There was a major push. There was beyond Margaret Thatcher, there was a push worldwide, because people were finally convinced of what was going on. Plus, they believed, at that time, people believed the science. So they had satellite observations that were confirming that there were dangerous plunges in the ozone layer at both poles. I had the privilege of sitting on a talk by one of the leading scientists who established that. He flew, he had balloon flights over Antarctica, and also had a U-2 flight, and developed experimental packages. And he went into in infinite detail about how he made the measurements and how they were confirmed, and then how he correlated his data with the satellites. And I think I still have a copy of his report for NASA that was at the time. And I'm just saying that I met, at that time, I actually got to meet a scientist who was actually working on the problem. And the reason I mention that is because today they never let any of these scientists who are working on the problem of climate change talk. You never see any forum where they include an actual climate scientist to talk about how they've got the data, it's extremely frustrating. As a matter of fact, the only time I saw was on Q&A. I watched it on YouTube when they had a discussion on climate science. They were going back and forth, and they actually had the scientist who was accused of his emails were hacked, and they were accusing him of falsifying his data by taking comments and statements out of context it tried to create a scandal around him that he recovered from eventually, but he was the only climate scientist there to sit on the panel to lend some authority to the discussion. And that to me is one of the things that's just really, I don't want to talk about politics right now, but anyway, the frustration is that the discussion of climate change has never been, I've never seen it taken in depth for a protracted discussion, deliberate, with people presenting their evidence and people presenting their refutations and having a long discussion. And it's really been something that's stuck in my craw. Come to think of it, Henry, I'm getting worked up. You want a beer? Would you like a beer?
Yeah, actually I would. It's 3:30 in the afternoon. Oh,
there you go, guys.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
The least I can do, man. You got me worked up on this thing, I think.
Talking of the ozone, is it going in the right direction now?
Yes, because they've reformulated. The main problem was propellants and refrigerants, and I believe the aerosol can issues, you know, it's hard to believe, but if you have 1 billion people on the planet, and most, if not all of them, have access to some kind of aerosol can.
I mean, you know, back in the 70s, everyone's, you know, women spraying their hair, men spraying their hair with these aerosol cans. And didn't they change what was in the aerosol cans?
I think they changed it from fluorocarbons to like something like CO2 or something like that. Or others, they just made pumps. Now there's lots of pump applicators that don't use any, you know, you pump the lid, the little cap on it some way, and it squirts. But and also the refrigeration system, they've changed the gas. Well, actually, it's semi-liquid gas substance. The coolant media that they use for refrigerants is now.
There's always a way, isn't there? There's always a way around this. So where are we at with this ozone? It's vastly improved, obviously, but are we going in the right direction?
Yes, it seems to be. I mean, I haven't really heard or seen anything about that. I mean, the main worry right now is climate change. So that's the thing. It's trying to get the what they call greenhouse gases. I kind of hate that term, but the
it's bandied about a lot. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that basically is that the effect that they have is the same as that they allow ultraviolet shortwave rays in to heat the planet, but they block infrared rays of the re-radiation back out to space, and as a result, and what we've just been through last February in Texas with the snowstorm is, you know, that's one example. People, you have to explain to people how a week-long snowstorm blizzard below us, almost Arctic temperatures in Texas, is caused by global warming.
But then how do you explain that? We had a prime minister called Tony Abbott, who, you know, he said this, it's cold outside. What are you talking about, global warming? I mean, how stupid can you get about this?
Well, your present prime minister is famous for having walked into Parliament with a lump of coal.
This is correct.
Remember that?
There was another
senator that we had in the United States. His last name was Inhofe, I forget his first name, who walked into the Senate carrying a snowball in winter.
Same sort of thing.
Yeah, trying to refute global warming, and he threw the snowball.
These people are running countries, you know? Yes. It's just absurd.
It is. Thomas... This is what you're up against. When trying to...
Oh, dear, I'm glad I don't have children. Thomas, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you for joining me here on Bondi Tunes.
My pleasure. Okay.
And we're just going to go out with Julian Lennon from the year 1990. It's all related to, you know, the ozone layer. And at that time in 1990, it was a problem. And this is called Saltwater. This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
In the UK, Ling Pang interviews people from all around the world, and she is Bondi Tunes International.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now!
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with Motown legends George Kerr and Marshall Thompson of the Shy Lights. Welcome, George and Marshall. How are you both?
I'm fine. Thank you.
George, you have produced a new song.
Yes.
For the Shanghai.
Correct. And that was really an experience. Marshall, he brought his group up and we recorded them. And as I was recording them, Al Goodman of Ray Goodman and Brown, PKA, The Moments, came into the studio. And Billy Brown came into the studio. And I said, since you guys are here, Marshall and I are going to put you guys to work. So then we put Al Goodman in the front. Al Goodman is doing the recitation in the front. And we put Billy Brown in the background so he could sing with the Shylights. And when we finished and everything, man, we thought it was really great. Marshall said, George, I really, really love this. He said, I really would like to have this as a single, you know, and I'll give it to Marshall. Marshall can tell you from there where we are with it.
Myself, absolutely love your music, Marshall, the Shylights. Let me tell you what songs I love. Have you seen her? Too Good to Be Forgotten.
Right.
They melt my heart,
Well, they
Marshall.
Love that song, yeah.
You are the founder.
Yeah, they love that song, yeah.
You're the founding member of the Shylights, isn't it, Marshall?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell me about your beginning, the Shylights, and how you come to join the
Shylights. Well, first of all, we started off in high school together. Okay, we had two different groups, the Desert Daryls and the Chanteurs. And two members of the Chanteurs fell out that group, and two members of the Desert Daryls fell out of our group. So what I did, after we was dealing and dabbling around high school, everybody got their jobs except me. I ended up being a drummer for Gladys Knight and the Pips at the Wrigley Theater here in Chicago. So I went there to get me a job with my snare drum, and the drummer was messing up her music at the Wrigley Theater. So I raised my hand. My hand at sound check. I said, Gladys, could I play your show? She said, come on up here and play this show. Come on up here. Could you play my show? I said, I've been rehearsing your show for 3 weeks. I live right up the street from the Wrigley Theater. So I went up there. I went up there and played her show. And I got the job for the week at the Wrigley Theater with her. Okay. And then when she left there, when she left to go back, I ended up playing with Major Lance. He had a record out called Monkey Time. Big record then. And so he said, he asked me, he said, Marshall, did you play with Gladys Knight? I heard you played with Gladys Knight. I said, yeah, I played for the Wrigley Theater for a whole week. He said, well, you can play for me. So I played for him for about a year and a half, and then came back home. When I got back home, then I hooked up with me and Joe Jackson as partners and took the Jackson 5 around all over Chicago, played them in all the clubs. And then they end up at the Wrigley Theater. Whoever win the talent show down there would get a chance to sing at the Wrigley Theater on a regular show with me and Bobby Taylor. So Bobby Taylor and the Van Cougars. So I went up there to try to get a job to get Bobby Taylor to take us to Motown. And Bobby said, man, Marshall, I think about that, because he was the headliner of the show. And Jackson 5 was tearing the stage up downstairs, Michael and them. So he said, who is that making that noise down there? All them girls screaming and hollering. I said, that's my little group. I play around Chicago. I play them on all the little clubs around here. So he said, take me down there and introduce me to them. So I took him downstairs and introduced him to Joe Jackson, the daddy. And then next morning, I get a call from Joe. Hey, hey Marshall. I said, what are y'all doing, man? He said, well, we on our way to Motown. I say, what? He said, yeah, we're going the way to Motown. Bobby said he's going to take us up. He liked our show. I said, he loved y'all's show when he did it, because that's why I took you down there and introduced him to you. And it was history for the Jacksons. And then when I got back home from Major Lance, okay, we came home. Then I got on the bus. I was on the bus going downtown, and I ended up downtown at where Brunswick Records office was. So when I got there, Otis LaVelle and Major Lance, they took me up there to meet Carl Davis. So I went up there and met Carl Davis. And who you think was coming up the steps? Jackie Wilson. So Jackie Wilson came up the steps, and I was freezing. I was shaking because of that big star like that at that time. You know, I said, wow. And he said, I heard you was a drummer. I said, yeah, you can play on one of my songs. So I ended up playing on one of his songs. And I went and got Eugene out of Cal, Gene Record. I got Squirrel, he was a welder, and Red was working at the post office. I said, y'all, come on down here. I got an audition with y'all, a chance to audition for Carl Davis. So we went down there, and we was calling Marshall and the Shoutlights then, you know. So we went down there, and we cut a song called Price of Love. That was our first record with Brunswick. Right? And Carl Davis, it was history from there. After that, we did the Price of Love. Then after that, we got into our management out of Jersey, Newark, New Jersey there. Mr. named Tommy Vistola, he was our manager, and he asked us to be on the Flip Wilson show because he managed all them people, Flip Wilson, Dick Clark, and all these people. So he asked us to be on the show, and we said, what? You're going to be on Dick Clark show and Flip Wilson show, Sammy Davis? He said, yeah, I manage all those people. So we ended up doing the Flip Wilson show, and we took Have You Seen It with us, okay, to do it on the show because we figured that was going to be the next one because when we got to St. Louis at Kiel Auditorium with Jackie Wilson, he had us on tour, we were singing the B-side. Okay, and people, we was on stage singing, we got off stage and people started talking about, have you seen her? Have you seen her? Have you seen her? We said, what? We don't. Oh. That's the B-side. That ain't no A-side. He said, you said E-side here in St. Louis, Missouri with at the Kiel Auditorium. So we end up going out there singing an acapella for 15 minutes because we didn't, the band didn't know it because we never rehearsed it with the band. So that kicks us off then. Then we got out of there, go back to the Flip Wilson show now. We go to Flip Wilson, Carl Davis say, take Old Girl with you. So I say, Old Girl, they ain't no hit record, Carl. He said, take it, trust me. So we took Old Girl to the Flip Wilson show with us. We did Have You Seen Her and Old Girl. And we got off, came back home from California. Next thing we know, and about a month later, Old Girl was number one on the pop chart. And Have You Seen It was number one on the R&B chart. So that kicked us off.
We never forget those songs, Marshall. They're like part of our life. We grow up with your music. You know, such a privilege to know that you are still continuing with music. And today, you are working together with the legendary George Kerr. And who's been on my show a couple of times, George. And George yourself is a legendary Motown artist, singer, staff, songwriter, arranger, and producer. And another is replacing Little Anthony with the famous Imperial.
Yes, Anthony was leaving and going solo. So I read in the Jet magazine that they were looking to replace Little Anthony. And so I went up with Sidney Barnes and to New York, and there were about 30 guys that was auditioning for the part. And it came down to me and Sidney out of all the guys. And then the next day we came, Richard Barrett was the, you know, he was the manager and the writer and the producer of Little Anthony. Yeah. And he picked me over Sidney Barnes. And I toured with them for about 2.5 years before I left to come back to try to do something on my own.
You are an incredible singer, very soulful voice. Your songs are called Faithfully Yours and Hey Girl, and one with a serenade is called Never Let Me Go, and they're beautiful songs. But you told me your passion is actually in songwriting.
Correct, that's right. I like to produce and write. Just singing was just something to be a way to be able for the people to hear my songs. I never wanted to try to be a singer because, you know, I really, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I can just carry a tune, you know. But I just love producing and writing. That's what I love to do, not just sing.
George, you wrote and sang Look What You Took.
No, don't ask me to come back. I couldn't take that kind of hurt again. You can keep everything. I just want out.
All the things remain, but oh, how this house has changed. Not the gifts I bought or your wedding ring. But when you pack your bags that day, you took a whole lot more, ooh, than you think away. Ooh, baby. When you said goodbye, girl, baby, look what you took. You took smells from the kitchen at dinner time with the table set. Your plate next to mine. You took my nights away and my days left too. They don't mean a thing if I can't spend them with you. You took the smile off my face and I know where it's at. It's in those bags. You took the happiness. this home left me in my tears here all alone. The only thing that you left without are the things that don't really count.
'Cause when you packed your bag that day, you took them all.
In the UK, Ling Pang interviews people from all around the world, and she is Bondi Tunes International.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with Motown legends George Kerr and Marshall Thompson of the Shy Lights about your new song, Working Together with the Shy Lights. That has sort of been released late January. Tell me, how this song come together with yourself and the Shy Lights?
Well, go ahead, Marshall.
Well, how the song got together? Well, when we got to the studio, George had these tracks for us. He had did. I said, what? And then I listened to it. I couldn't believe it. George was so chops in the music. I said, well, I'm going to get with me another genius in this chat, like Eugene. I said, we got another guy like Eugene Records here, George Kerr. So I knew him from all them hits he had. So we went in there and we started working on it. I had a couple of lead singers that was doing it, and one of the guys couldn't cut it. So I had Anthony Watson. I told Anthony, go in there and get that song done. So Anthony went in there and did his thing. Next thing I know, George put Al Goodman on there. And we started doing that bass. Oh, he really brought it out then. And so George made up that part. Tell me, he said, I found love on the two-way street, and I want to know, have you seen her? I said, perfect. That's perfect, man. That's right on time. So I called George because I had seen it. He had the album out on YouTube and stuff. So I called him. I said, man, you better release that Dove on the two-way street, man. That they went crazy over the thing. And now we're going into Valentine's Day, and people calling me already. I want my Valentine's record. I want my Valentine's record. Love on the two-way street, Shine Lights and Friends. So I'm very excited about that, you know.
They are very romantic songs. Make women ourselves feel so beautiful.
Oh, yes. The ladies really love it. They love it. And I can't wait to do it on stage myself when we do it on our concert tour. Because we get ready. I guess you know about us getting our star in Hollywood, you know. Yeah, we're getting a star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So we'll be getting that. So they're excited when we leave there. We're going to hit them Coliseums like we always pray and do our George's song level on Two-Way Street. George is one of the guaranteed greatest producers ever came up in the business. You know, he's one of the greatest ever came up in the business, you know. And it was so exciting to be there. And I couldn't believe it when we was in Jersey when he came down with all those song tracks and stuff. And he did some more things. He even remade Our Coldest Day of My Life that we had one of our hits. He did a great job.
George worked with so many people for both the Shy Lights and George worked together. This song's going to be a success.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I want to congratulate the Shy Lights. Next month, your band is to be inducted in the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
That's cool. It'll be about 2 months from now. They pushed it back because of the pandemic here. But everybody's excited about it. You know, they're ready.
This is wonderful that you guys
deserve.
Thank
you so much. So, well, this is 62 years for me with the Shy Lights when I started it. So, a little while.
I'm so happy to hear that Shy Lights is continuing to produce music. So you never have a career break, Marshall?
No, I've been, ever since I started it, I'm the last man standing, and I'm still here. How could you stop with a producer like George all my guys are gone, passed away, and here George, I call my friend, I say, George, Man, what you gonna do with that album, man? You got some hits on that album. He talking about, I do. I say, what you mean you do? You know you got some hits on that album, man. And everybody that I sent Love on a Two-Way Street to, Shy Lighton's friend, everybody added it at the same time, added the record, same time. No, it's unbelievable.
Well, George Coe is a legend of legends. I mean, look at all these people that he had worked and produced music for. The OJs, Linda Jones, The Warnod, Marvin Gaye, The Moment, Edwin Starr, and The Manhattans. George, you work endlessly and you love what you do. And you said when you look for someone to work with you, you don't want somebody just good. You want somebody who's extra good, not 100%, but give 110%.
Correct. That's right, because what you're doing, you're selling to the public, and it's so hard to, and I always tell the artists, you know, it's hard to sell a record. You are not just selling a luxury, you know, that this is, you're selling a luxury, not a necessity. A person does not need to have a record to live. You know, it's not a necessity, so you must be very, very good for a person to go out and buy something that's new, you know? So you've got to be really, really good. So I want to try to get the very, very best that I can get, the best song, the best arrangement of the song, the best studio, and the best artist, and then that gives you a great chance of getting a hit record.
Marshall, you are a performer, an artist. Do you also do songwriting?
No,
Marshall?
Eugene Record did all the songwriting. I'm the driving force of the group. I've always been a driving force. Make sure when they write something, you got to have somewhere to take it, and I'm the one who had to take it.
Mm-hmm. Marshall, since the 70s, has the members of the Shy Lights been changed?
Oh, yeah. I have some local guys that I put together that sounds exactly like my group, that I take them out, and I put them on stage, and they do the job.
Is there a special quality that you need, a certain standard that you look for? How do you know about it? Is it instinct? Do you feel it in your body?
Well, out of being with the group 62 years, and we did all our own music. A lot of groups don't even sing their background on some of them records. I sung on every record we had. Our Shy Lights, we sung on every background, every song that we ever did, produced or anything. We did everything. And so I know what to look for. I know what this sound is supposed to sound like. I know what that sound, I know what this guy's supposed to sound like. So over the years, it just stuck with me. And that's what I got right now. I got a group that's very tight, sounds just like the group. It's a little different. You sound a little different, but you're not going to find that much.
George, you have never really learned music at college, but you knew how to make music through
your heart. God gave me this talent. I was writing songs. I wrote my first song when I was about 6 years old. I had was just words. And when I got to be about eight, nine, then that's when I started to hear music, you know, horns and strings and the whole bit at that early age. So then when I got about 14 years old, then I started to really, really, really could put all the harmonies together. The harmonies that I put together, it's just God gave it to me. I don't know where it came from other than God, because I could arrange my music. I could write my music. You know, I did everything but play instruments. So I used to hum the parts to my arrangers, different parts, and then after I had given them what I wanted, then they put sweetening around it, and it came out to be like a George Kerr song. You know, I had a different sound from everybody else because I just went and gave the arranger what I heard. You know, I didn't have any musical training at all. It was just God's gift.
Got it in you. It's
correct.
Natural.
It's better when it's natural.
Marshall, I understand that you have been musical from from childhood.
Yeah, my whole family's been inclined. My whole family, my dad played with Satchmo, you know, Louis Armstrong. Okay, my uncle. Yeah.
So it's not a surprise, Marshall, for you to become who you are today.
Right, and you hear me on Congos. I'm playing on Crazy in Love Beyonce song, that's me playing the congos on there. Okay, and then Jay-Z, December 4th, all those songs, I'm doing all those songs. Mm-hmm. Those are tracks that we recorded, Are You My Woman, and That's How Long I Love You.
You know, the women or the parents or the mothers in your life, they must be so lucky to have you guys around them because you make us feel so wonderful.
Thank you so much.
When they get, when you get George Curry in the house, you got to be doing something.
And Marshall, the Shy Light, are you guys planning on coming to the UK?
Yeah, they've been calling me now. See, the Hollywood Walk of Fame have everybody calling me. I'm doing a lot of Zooms, interviews. I got Zoom interviews all over the place right now. Mm. So we're really going to be coming out there doing that. And you can let people know that we'll be coming out that way soon. You know, once we get out the Hollywood Walk of Fame, we'll be doing that new cut, Hard Love on a Two-Way Street. By the Starlights and Friends. We can't wait to get over there, you know. Especially I get to get over there and see my grandkids. All my grandkids in Manchester, England with my son. And I got to get over there and see him. I call him. We Skype and Zoom on the phone. It's just about every week we talk. I see our kids. And the kids over there, they studying music as well.
My own daughter and granddaughter is from Manchester, too. Yeah, Manchester.
That's where my son and grandkids is. I got about 10 grandkids there.
Congratulations. George, you told me about 2 years ago, you came to UK to sign a book.
Yes, right. I was in Manchester. I went over.
In Manchester. Boy, you sticking with my family, boy. You can't get rid of me.
That's the way I was. I took about 320 books, and then I had also audio book also, and I took 200 of those, and they sold out in about 30 minutes. You know, I went over to do question and answers, and I was in this auditorium, and I could not believe it. Over 1,600 people came just to hear me talk.
Wow.
So, and I want to thank you and your fans, all your listeners over there. Just give them my love because they have been so wonderful with my music. You know, they have really kept me going all of these years. They love my music, and I went over there, and it just made me feel so wonderful, like I had been there all my life. So I love your listeners. God bless them.
UK are music lovers.
Yeah. I mean, they love their music. I mean, we was over there with Mary Wilson about five years ago. We sold out. We stayed over there for 30 days, and we sold every concert out.
And the Shy Light is global. You know,
we've been blessed. We've been blessed to have worldwide music. That stuff is played everywhere.
How do you guys stay healthy at the moment because you can't perform?
I'm on that computer. I'm a computer whiz person. I've been doing a computer for 22 years. It helped me. My wife had passed away, and she told me, "Say you got to learn that computer because that's what's going to be the way of the world." And here it is.
So, George, are you continue to do more music with the Shy Lights in the coming year?
Oh yes. Well, the next record we're going to release is that record that Marsha loves. Coldest Day of My Life.
Can you guys introduce your new song, please?
Go ahead, Marshall.
I tell you one thing. You can look for it too on shylights.info. That's my website if you want to talk about keep up with the Shy Lights dates and everything. Go to shylights.info.
Can you say your website again?
Shylight.info. shylights.info.
The new songs available now on Spotify and Amazon.
Yes, they are.
Get ready for the latest. This record here looks like it's going all the way from the lovers. All the ladies, put your arm around your young man. Young man, put your arm around the young lady and say, "I will have found you on a two-way street. I got love on a two-way street."
Thank you so much.
Keep in touch with us. Let us know how the record is doing.
I will. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I want to know, have you seen her? I found love on a two-way street. And I lost it on a lonely highway. And I want to know, have you seen her?
I found love.
This is Ling Pang for Bond 9 Tunes International, and I talked with Motown legends George Kerr and Marshall Thompson of the Shy Lights.
Henry O'Donovan.